dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has rendered considerable service over many years in that war, in a variety of interesting capacities, is our first guest. His name is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez. These days, he is the vice president of an extraordinarily important organization, the Middle East Media Research Institute. But he formerly served as, among other things, the president of the Middle East Broadcasting Network, which included several arms of the United States government that aimed to express and convey to people in the Middle East, obviously, information that they're not otherwise likely to get. He has also served in the State Department in a number of capacities, rising to the rank of ambassador for the nation of Equatorial Guinea and the chargé d'affaires in Khartoum, Sudan. A man of many parts, good friend, and always a welcome guest here. Ambassador, good to have you. Welcome back. I wanted to catch up with you on a topic that I know from your previous incarnation is very much top of mind for you, and I think should be for all of us, Alberto, and that is what Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, is up to, as evidenced by his action in just the past few days to convert a very beautiful former basilica, cathedral, if you will, of the Christian faith, to a mosque. I believe it's called the Hagia Sophia, and it's, of course, in Istanbul, Turkey. What's that all about, as you see it?
Well, it's two things. Obviously, it's an election promise he made during elections last year for the mayoralty of Istanbul, where his party, which is an Islamist party, was opposed by a more secular party. And so he threw that out to try to kind of win more of the Islamist vote. And so ostensibly that's what it is. It's correcting in his eyes a wrong that was done by the secularist founder of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who turned the Basilica of the Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia, from a mosque into a museum in 1934. Of course, it was the great cathedral of the Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire until the city fell to the Turks in 1453. The larger thing, though, is not about that one step, you know, whether this historic church is a church or a mosque or a museum. The larger context, of course, is Erdogan's Islamization of Turkey and his regional Islamist ambitions. I mean, this event which happened is a small part of a much broader series of actions, activities, and efforts to kind of promote a supremacist worldview, to change the status quo inside Turkey, and to promote it regionally, in the Arab world, and basically anywhere in the world that he can.
This is really the crux of the problem, isn't it? We've watched him inexorably acting on this agenda for, well, as long as he's been in power, first as prime minister and now as president, Alberto. And if you were to characterize those ambitions, they would be, I assume, somewhat theocratic as well as strategic. And how would they best be defined as you see them? Supremacist, I think of it as sort of Sharia supremacism, but more specifically, what are his goals as you see them?
Well, of course, the party he represents, the AKP, is an Islamist party. It's akin to the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey. I mean, that's basically its ideology. And Erdogan is now allied with a kind of nationalist party, a non-religious nationalist party, which is kind of a perfect segue in the kind of the two sides of his agenda. Part of it is something which, to be honest, lots of governments do, which is a kind of aggrandizing Turkey's role in the world. And you can't fault him for that. Many nationalist leaders in the world try to do that, from India to other places. That's one thing. But it's allied with this toxic ethno-religious ideology, which includes promoting radicalism throughout the world, throughout the Muslim world. Turkey today, for example, hosts a dozen Islamist television stations, satellite television stations, beaming poison, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, extremist Islamist poison into the Arab world. These are many people that were displaced when pressure was brought to bear on Qatar, or when Sisi, General Sisi, overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and a lot of these people wound up in Sudan, where they've opened up satellite television stations, basically preaching all kinds of hate and incitement to the Arab world. Of course, there are other, you know, there's a military dimension, there's a security dimension, there's an alliance with America's enemies from Venezuela to Iran. But it is an ideological project. Yes, China as well.
Yeah. And I think what most of us still aren't clear about, Mr. Ambassador, is the extent to which this is really a virulently anti-American agenda as well. The broadcasting, the indoctrination, the agitation, the subversion has at its core, does it not, going after U.S. interests and allies, and indeed the United States itself, particularly through its partnership with the Muslim Brotherhood you mentioned a moment ago?
Well, in this, Erdogan is following a well-trodden path, one which was pioneered, among others, by his ideological ally in Qatar, which is you cooperate with the Americans in some areas, especially areas related to kind of military security cooperation, narrowly defined. And that gives you carte blanche to pursue your kind of ideological worldview, which is much broader, which is inherently and deeply and aggressively anti-American. And you hope and you expect that the Americans are going to be satisfied with whatever breadcrumbs they get from an Air Force base or landing rights or whatever. They'll ignore the steady drumbeat of political incitement in the media, of actions taken, allies with enemies of the United States that affect the security of the United States. And somehow the Americans will say, well, you know, yes, he says all these terrible things. He does all these terrible things. But we have an Air Force base in Turkey, so we should kind of, you know, give him some slack.
And unfortunately, as you know so well, this has worked like a top, not just for the Qataris, but for the Turks as well. We have to leave it there for the moment, but I hope that you will come back to us with more on this. We'll be visiting a bit more about it as well with Robert Spencer momentarily, but we appreciate so much your insights, as well as the extraordinarily important work, as I say, that you're doing with the Middle East Media Research Institute, a mechanism for helping Americans understand what is actually being said in the Middle East in various foreign languages. Thank you for that work, sir, as well as your cumulative public service in various other capacities. Come back to us again if you would soon. Next up, as promised, Robert Spencer, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, as promised, joined by Robert Spencer, one of the greatest monitors and analysts and documenters of the phenomenon that I think of as Sharia supremacism. It's the authoritative doctrine of Islam. It mandates that its followers perform jihad, and few, if anybody, have done more to help us really understand what all that's about than Robert. He is the author of more books than I can count, including The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS, The Truth About Muhammad, The Palestinian Delusion, and one of my personal favorites, The Stealth Jihad. Robert Spencer is also to be found on the pages of Front Page magazine and PJ Media, and of course on his absolutely indispensable blog site, jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Robert Spencer, it is so good to have you back. Welcome. I think I am also supposed to say you are a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, which is especially appreciated in light of all these wonderful accomplishments. Let me ask you, Robert, we spoke earlier in the program with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez about what it has meant to the free world, really, on the one hand, and to the aspirations of these Sharia supremacists that Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey has now turned this beautiful basilica, which has been for many decades now a museum, once again, into a mosque for the use of people like him and his agenda. What do you think?
It heralds a great deal more to come, and I think it will be coming quickly. We should remember that this was the foremost, largest, most imposing, most beautiful, awe-inspiring cathedral in the Christian world for nearly 1,000 years. It was converted to a mosque on May 29, 1453, when the Ottoman Turks conquered Constantinople and ended the Byzantine Empire, which was Christian. Now, that means that this has extraordinary symbolic importance. The secular Turkish government made the Hagia Sophia into a museum in 1935, and that was a signal of the end of the caliphate, which had been ended actually about a little over a decade before that. And now, the turning of the museum back into a mosque is Erdogan's signal that he is absolutely intent on restoring the Ottoman Caliphate. And that means, especially in light of some statements that he made in 2018 regarding never having recognized territorial losses by Turkey after World War I, this is extremely significant. He's positioning himself as the new caliph and may well now set out to recover the territories that he believes belong to his caliphate.
And as you've documented in one of your postings at Jihad Watch, as I recall, Robert, he's been rather explicit about the breadth of those ambitions. Can you just give us a flavor of it? Because I think a lot of us would find unimaginable that he would be laying claim to parts of, well, Spain, for example.
Yeah, but he is. It's very clear. When he says that the Ottoman territories, and he has said exactly this, that the Ottoman territories belong by right to Turkey today, then he's talking about an empire that once stretched from Spain all the way across North Africa into the Middle East and then up into Eastern Europe. So he's talking about recovery and Central Asia to some degree up to the border of Iran at its highest point. And so we're talking about a huge expanse of territory, not to say that he's going to recover all that, but that he may well put Turkey on a very bellicose stance that will set him on a war footing with many of those countries, probably the ones nearest to him in his neighborhood there immediately, such as Greece and Egypt, and then expand from there if there is no pushback. And so the supine response from Western leaders to this extraordinarily important symbolic move of making Hagia Sophia into a mosque again is deeply unwise in light of his own stated explicit aspirations.
Two things jump out from that, Robert, that I'd ask you to address a little bit further. The historic practice of these jihadists from Muhammad's day forward, as you've documented, of transforming the most prized possessions, installations, facilities, houses of worship, most especially, of their conquered enemies into mosques is a well-established psychological practice as well as symbolic, is it not? And secondly, the degree to which this response really has been supine, if you might talk a little bit about that too.
Sure. In the first place, yes, there is an old adage that goes back to the beginning of Islam, that Islam must dominate and not be dominated. This has been lived out over the centuries, as I show in the history of jihad. Everywhere that Islam has conquered and Islamic law been imposed, then houses of worship of non-Muslims have been appropriated and either destroyed and mosques built over them, as has happened many, many times with Hindu temples in India, or the buildings themselves appropriated for use by the Muslims, notably the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, Istanbul, but in many, many other churches in Turkey and elsewhere in the Islamic world. And both of these are gestures of supremacism and triumph that Islam is proclaiming that it is victorious over other religions and thus has by right the ownership of their houses of worship and can appropriate them as monuments to the victory of Islam and the superiority of Islam over these other religions. This is very, very ignored in the West, and there has been no policy discussion, no public discussion, no investigation of the implications of this at all, and yet the implications of this are very large. What we have instead is, take for example Pope Francis, he quite late said simply, "I think of Hagia Sophia and I'm very saddened." Well, that's nice, but what exactly does it mean? It's very unclear. It's ambiguous. Is he saddened because the museum has been turned into a mosque? Or is he saddened because this shows up the futility and self-defeating nature of the dialogue that he's been pursuing with Muslim Brotherhood entities and others for the last few years? Or is he saddened because this is a harbinger of more to come? He doesn't dare to be more explicit about it, no doubt because he does not want to offend his Muslim dialogue partners.
I think the term he actually used was pained, and another possible interpretation is pained by the fact that it should be patently obvious to all of us that he's been taken for a fool. He's been used, and in the service of this interfaith dialogue business, he has demonstrably weakened the West and emboldened its adversaries, including Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Yeah, there's no doubt. It kind of shows up the futility of a dialogue process that wasn't able to prevent this conversion of the Hagia Sophia into a mosque and closing it off as a monument to that was open to all people. It shows that he's been engaged in this useless and frivolous exercise, and maybe that's dawning on the Pope himself today. I don't know.
I surely hope so, because there's a lot of course correcting he needs to do this fall. As you know, Robert Spencer, you've been warning of this for some time. He's embarking on new paroxysms of interfaith dialogue and economic redistributionist agendas and the like. And it's high time that he recognize the errors of his ways and as I say, corrected course. Robert, one other thing that we touched on with Ambassador Fernandez, but I'd like to get your thoughts on as well, is something that's making this particularly ominous is not only the ambition of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, but the alliances that he is striking with nations that have a similar desire, if not the same end state, a similar desire to weaken the West and ultimately force it to submit. I'm thinking particularly of Communist China, for example, and Russia, and Iran, even, and Qatar, and the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about those partnerships, if you would.
Yeah, well, you know, they're alliances of convenience, certainly, especially in the case of Russia, which is probably the closest of all those to Turkey at this point, and very self-defeating on the part of Putin, given his attempts to revive Christianity in Russia and the Russian Orthodox Church's stated opposition to the conversion of Hagia Sophia. But it kind of shows up, actually, here again, that Russia's been on the wrong track, that it's unwise to pursue alliances with Turkey. It also shows up in the reality of the alliances that Turkey has been making, that it's high time that Turkey be expelled from NATO. It is not an ally of the United States, not an ally of the European Union. It is pursuing an agenda that is inimical to the United States and to the European Union. But this has not been recognized because we're still operating according to these old, outmoded, and failed Cold War models of who the adversary is that we need to be facing up against. But Turkey has shown itself again in this decision to be no friend of the West and should not be treated as such.
It is an ally no more, as we said in a monograph of the Center for Security Policy, to which I believe you contributed, Robert Spencer. Thank you for this incredibly important and timely warning to the West. God bless you and the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. Check it out, folks, as well as Robert Spencer's enormous library of important books, as well as his ongoing commentaries at PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. Come back to us soon, my friend, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Bradley Thayer about China, speaking of Turkey's friend, and what it might mean up to that's inimical to our interests as well, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we're joined by one of the members of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, among other important incarnations and attributes. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. These days, he is a professor of international politics at the University of Texas, San Antonio. He has been associated with the Kennedy School of Government and St. Anthony's College at Oxford. Also has worked for the Defense Department in a variety of capacities, a PhD from the University of Chicago, and the author most recently of How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Bradley Thayer, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Thank you, Frank, for the opportunity. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, the pleasure is ours. Let me talk to you first and foremost, Brad, about something that you've really devoted a lot of your professional career to doing, which is properly understanding the nature and the ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party. You've talked about it, of course, in this very important book, in terms of the kind of racist character of this regime. It's Han centrism, as you call it. But give us just sort of an overview as we're coming to grips with so many different manifestations of this operation. What is it we're really up against?
We're up against a peer competitive challenge, the likes of which we've never seen in U.S. history. China is remarkable in three respects. First, that the United States cooperated with the Chinese economically, technologically, in education, many other areas to actually accelerate China's growth. Secondly, we worked with international institutions, thinking that China would, as it engaged with international institutions, would change its behavior and reform politically its political institutions. Third big problem, of course, is the fundamental one, and that is our assumptions were heavily colored by the end of history mindset. We were heavily U.S. decision makers, and in the West more broadly, were heavily informed by that. We thought great power competition was over, and we would never face this again with the Soviet Union disappearing. China, for the first two reasons, would be able to grow into a cooperative partner for the United States.
Basically, that we had won, right? That the world was our oyster, and everything else was just going to fall into place along our lines.
And that captured us for a generation, right? It's only our balancing against China was incredibly tardy, and I think the Cleo is the muse of history, and she's not going to be kind when she renders her judgments on the United States strategic community.
Unfortunately, as I don't need to tell you, sir, as a professor of history. History is, of course, written by the victors. And in this case, Cleo may be working for the Chinese Communist Party if we're not careful. So you've written recently about both the need for realism in a piece at The Hill, but also this question that it seems we largely overlook, Bradley Thayer, and that is that this regime in China is not just a threat to us, but that fundamentally it is illegitimate. And we ought to be sort of operating
on that basis, particularly in terms of both how we deal with them, of course, but how we deal with the people of China as well. Talk us through that a bit, if you would.
Indeed, Frank. That is the arguments I make, is that the government of China is an illegitimate government. And United States decision makers and the American people need to recognize that. Secondly, China is a foe of the United States. Their political principles, interests, and vision of international politics possessed by Beijing and then also by Washington are irreconcilable. And that's a fundamental fact of international politics, right? We need to recognize what's right in front of our nose. And the China threat and the fact that it is a foe is absolutely important to understand. The regime, thirdly, is illegitimate. And a consequence is that it has to pursue social imperialism by advancing and sustaining hatred of other states and peoples in order to generate sufficient popular domestic support that ensures the position of the Communist Party of China, but that also illuminates that it's a very dangerous and destabilizing non-status quo regime. Additionally, the regime is aware of its insecurity, right? It knows that it's illegitimate, and thus it has, if you will, that tremendous chip on its shoulder, right? We should expect that it's going to be hostile and resort to aggression to advance its interests in global politics and to sustain its grip on the Chinese people. The Chinese people have suffered, right? That is, the regime has abused them from its inception in 1949.
Including by killing millions of them and enslaving the rest, right? Which brings me back to the legitimacy question. Drill down for a moment on this, because it so much of what you've just said really flows from it. What is the source of political legitimacy?
The source of political legitimacy, as traditionally defined in politics, is rationality, right? As Weber famously defined it. That is that consent from the governed has to be provided to political authority. In the absence of that, any government which does that, totalitarian governments, authoritarian governments, are illegitimate.
And they rule, typically, by force. And what you've just described, which is so worrying, especially as we see the correlation of forces, as the Soviet communists used to say, seemingly shifting dramatically in China's favor, is that the social engineering, if I can use that expression, that they've been engaging in to try to manipulate their population or at least divert its anger that might otherwise be directed at the regime elsewhere, can serve as a catalyst for aggression, and not just against, you know, the people of Hong Kong, which we're watching play out as we speak, but perhaps Taiwan, perhaps others in the region, and needless to say, perhaps against us as well. No?
Indeed. It's a dangerous regime, and it's an insecure regime. And we should suspect that and plan, in terms of our strategic conceptions, that it's hostile to us, and it could resort to aggression at any time.
Let me ask you about one thing that Brad, is top of mind, I think, for many of us in the Committee on the Present Danger, which is this: given everything you've just said, it seems it's absolute madness that we would be allowing companies that are integral to this threat from China, that are part of the military-industrial complex of the Chinese Communist Party, to be doing business in the United States. And by that I mean they're doing joint ventures, they're buying up American companies. Obviously, they do what Chinese companies do at the direction of their party. Stealing technology, you know, engaging in espionage, subversion, what have you. But, and raising money in our capital markets to boot. I mean, how insane? I mean, if I can ask you to sort of project back, you know, forward again, how historians are going to look at this behavior and what do you think it's likely to conduce to if we're not careful?
Frank, it's almost as though we took the playbook of our victory in the Cold War against the Soviet Union and did the opposite in every respect. Right? We knew that the Soviets were a threat. We treated them as a threat. We kept them out of our capital markets. We kept them out. Cooperation was always tenuous. with the Soviets for good reasons. China, we did the opposite of that. We let them into the economic thought triumphed over strategic thought. And so the economist worldview that absolute gains for all, any type of cooperation is going to be a win-win for both sides, and we're all going to get richer. And the implicit assumption is rich people don't fight. Rich states won't fight as they're integrated together. That was fundamentally wrong and in the deepest and most profound sense. And so why strategic thought took a holiday is a very important issue that needs to be explored. And there has to be a reckoning about how we could get this so wrong.
Again, as a serious student of China and its governing party, the Chinese Communist Party, Bradley Thayer, I know you are very familiar with Deng Xiaoping's approach when, as he famously put it, apparently to party cadre, the Soviet Union lost the Cold War with the United States and a new Cold War was going to begin and it was going to be won by China. I would suggest to you that a big part of why we got this so fundamentally wrong to our mortal peril, particularly as it has played out over the past couple of decades, is as a direct result of their policies, their plans, their deception, their hide and bide strategy that enabled the Chinese to sort of turn upside down the model that they watched enable us to win the Cold War.
They're a profound foe who have used, it's a masterclass of how Deng Xiaoping was able to structure, learn from the Soviet collapse and ensure that China never would go through that, while at the same time doing everything it could do to hide its capabilities and to bide its time as it continued to grow. So our foe, the fact that China did that shows their genius, in essence. But it was our fault, right, that we should have recognized that China was a threat and that they were doing this, as a small number of individuals did, of course, in the wake of the end of the Cold War. But the fault is on us, right? Our foe is genius, right? But we should be able to confront and defeat China. And the fact that we have been, again, so tardy puts us in our deleterious situation presently, where we have to redouble our efforts to balance against China.
It starts with clarity about the nature of the enemy, doesn't it? Brad Thayer, thank you for your time today. We'll talk with you again soon, sir. Very, very soon, I hope. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Charles. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we have the privilege of being, as we often do, in-house, virtually, one of our good friends. His name is Robert Charles. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs in the George W. Bush State Department. He has served in a number of other capacities over the years, including as an attorney in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He's been a naval intelligence officer. He has also been enormously contributing to what I think all of the rest of us know and understand about our times, notably through his appearances on Fox News and his essays at the Association of Mature American Citizens website, for which is amac.us. Bobby Charles is an AMAC spokesman. We're so appreciative of your time, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for coming back on. Good to talk with you. Let's start with some of the ruminations you have been engaging in various outlets about this, well, I think of it as a revolution that is underway in our cities, a couple of pieces of which are very worrying. And I know from your experiences overseas that you've had some insights into what similar kinds of things have looked like elsewhere. Talk about that.
Yes, well, you put your finger on a very important point. You know, I'll reference AMAC just to say that some of us, you and I and others of the AMAC generation over the age of 50, grew up in a world that was defined by the Cold War. And to that end, I spent a little bit of time, a couple of different times in the Soviet Union and a couple of months in Soviet-dominated Poland. And really three things come to my mind in this current moment, and they're somewhat, they're really arresting in my own mind's eye. The first is that people, a lot of our population today does not understand what socialism and communism is really about. If you wind the clock back and just spend a little bit of time understanding how the socialist governments repress every right that we deem important, from freedom of speech and worship to even just not being arrested and dragged off the street. It is a very, I don't even know how to describe it except to say that it represses everything that we treasure as Americans. And I don't think people realize that that's what we're up against. The second thing is that people don't realize how fast it moves. You know, the Bolshevik Revolution took all of about 6 years, from 1917 to 23, and it was over. The Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949, had started in 1921, but the seeds were all laid ahead of time. We did our level best to try to prevent that, but we couldn't. So the second thing to note is that a very stable, seemingly very at ease, open, free society can, in a very short period of time, come under the influence and become essentially dominated by a socialist government, which is frightening. The third thing is really the practical or tactical side of all this. And I find it fascinating that a wonderful 4th of July passed a week or so ago, and yet we are looking at a situation in which much of the violence that occurred across the United States was not even reported by the mainstream media in those 3 or 4 days following. That disturbs me, because without law enforcement, we are up a creek without a paddle. We have to treasure, we have to understand the extraordinary pressures that are being placed on our law enforcement men and women today in every single major metropolitan area in the country. And I think to that end also, I just want to say that I talk with law enforcement a lot. And one of the things they've told me is that these events that are occurring now are definitely coordinated. The violence that continues to occur is coordinated. They've told me about plats of bricks that have been laid down everywhere from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. And it is a prearranged, you know, whether they were waiting for a flashpoint or this. And the saddest part about all this is that we can have a civil discussion about racial inequities and how to amend them, but that discussion has been sidetracked, hijacked, and taken away by these organized, I think, socialist and in some ways foreign-inspired disturbances, and it is very disturbing.
It is indeed, and I think your insights, Bobby, in terms of both the history of all of this and the implications of it becoming, you know, vastly more problematic, is really important, and we, you know, fail to acknowledge it at our extreme peril.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things we're not hearing from, where is the mainstream media reporting what the police unions are saying? Where is the mainstream media reporting, which they're not, that 71% of the DC police force, which is 52% black, have said that if their qualified immunity is taken away, as the city council seems to want to do, they're going to put their papers in and leave. Where's the reporting that you have literally thousands of police officers who were injured in the recent spate of events in the last 3 weeks, really now 4 weeks? Where's the reporting from that police officers are saying, you know what, I am sick and tired of this? I mean, a 49% increase in the retirement requests in New York City's police force. This has got to be reported. And what I would encourage every listener to do, whether you're, you know, local in the D.C. area or you're national somewhere and accessing this broadcast, I would tell you, demonstrate your support to your local police, because by God, if we lose them and their support and we fail to acknowledge their selfless acts, then the next step is the ceding of all that ground to these socialist / communist, and anyways, you know, sort of hybrid fascists that are being inspired by foreign nationals.
I want to come back to the police in a minute. I did catch on Maria Bartiromo's show this morning. I believe it was a candidate for Congress in Miami by the name of Maria Elvira Salazar, who is, I believe, part of the Cuban American community in South Florida, and spoke very pointedly about the fact that, you know, you mentioned the term socialism, democratic socialism. She said, there's no such thing as democratic socialism. She said, it's like democratic fascism. You know, what? No way. It's communism, and it's maybe just a way station to it, but it is Marxist, it is totalitarian, and it is revolutionary in our own country. And so to come to the police, if I can, because I think this is such a critical part of the story, and with your background, notably at the State Department, with law enforcement affairs as part of your portfolio, you have a special appreciation of how that thin blue line really is vital to keeping the rest of us not only safe, but on the right side of truly disorder and mayhem and revolution in our own time. And I just would ask you, we're hearing more and more and more about the police being demoralized. We're hearing about large numbers retiring early. I think 400% more in New York City this time as opposed to last year this time. We're hearing about perhaps some of them choosing not to respond as promptly to reports of dangerous incidents. Talk about what all this means for the fabric of society.
Yep. I think that one of the things we have to do as observers, getting our news from a spattering and a smattering of different sources, is to put the dots together to create a pointillistic picture from what we're seeing, all these dots on the page. And I'll say four things pop off the page to me. One is that the police forces around the country are definitely demoralized. They do not understand why the public doesn't understand how vital their role is and what they do every day. I mean, they get up every day, they have families, and they put on a gun and a badge, and they go out to protect us. That's the first thing. The second thing is there is a nexus, and people need to understand it. All you have to do is go to the Customs and Border Patrol forms that people fill out coming into this country or to be a naturalized citizen to understand that if you are advocating the toppling of our democratic government, you're not welcome as a naturalized citizen in this country. And you know, when you're seeking through violent means to overturn the United States government, you are on the other side of the law, which leads me to the third point, which is that we cannot lose the ability to distinguish between lawful and lawless behavior. The toppling of statues, I mean, the most recent are a combination of union leaders but also political leaders, including, you know, ironically enough, Frederick Douglass statue had recently toppled. The irony in all this is that if you do not prosecute lawless behavior, you allow lawlessness to grow. And as you know, Edmund Burke famously said, all it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. We need our law enforcement. We need the rest of us to be supportive of them. The last point I'll make is that I spent time in more than 50 countries, both before and during being Assistant Secretary of State. And I will tell you, my job was to set up law enforcement all around the world. And one of the things that becomes very obvious is if you do not have that deterrent, if you do not have credible law enforcement, everything goes to Hades and a rocket ship real fast. And that we saw in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Colombia. I mean, you pick the country that has experienced instability. And we, you know, and so, you know, we certainly cannot lose that at home. I mean, we try our level best all around the world to help seed rule of law, and we certainly can't lose it at home.
Robert Charles, we appreciate so much both the clarity with which you address these issues, your historical perspective, and the great work that you do on behalf of the Association of Mature American Citizens. I know you'll come back to us again soon, and we look forward to it greatly. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.